Today we're going to talk about biblical archaeology. It's before I do that, something to wake you up there. Take a look at that for a moment. That's our dear Hugh. Couldn't resist that. Found it in the comic. Made a few little minor changes on it. Go back for a second. Did you catch it all? Look in the couch there, and Hugh Ross's couch, and the new creation. Think he'll look like that? Okay. Why am I talking about this? Well, I was always kind of interested in archaeology. I'm an ecologist, not an archaeologist, but I'm one of the reasons to believe volunteer apologists. So, you know, we have to kind of generalize. And as an apologist, ecologist, I had to generalize. So I got interested and took their course. And part of the reason I'm talking today is to get you to take the course too. It's a 15-week course. You can find it at reasons.org, Reasons Institute. Dr. John Bloom of Biola University puts it together. It's next one starts January 2013, and it includes information on as listed there. So it's very exciting. Myself, have I ever done any archaeology? A little bit. The course does not have any field aspects to it, so. But it's all online, and there's no classroom. But it's a very good course. And I used to work at the Natural History Museum right here in L.A. County, and helped with paleontological digs. So we dug up fossils, whales, and even some dinosaurs and ammonites and things. And I accompanied the archaeologist at times, too, into the field. And also when I worked at the Army Corps of Engineers, which I retired from a couple years ago, went out in the field a lot with the archaeologists. So I had to help survey. So I do have a little bit of hands-on. I'm not totally armchair. And So what is archaeology? You should have a handout. And that handout has definitions on it. So refer to that occasionally if you would, please. And if you don't have one, just raise your hand and Valerie will get you one. And grab and run. Well, it was up until about 100 years ago. I think this movie was in the 30s or so. It's supposed to be in the 30s. But, it was. People used to just grab it, run, put it in museums around the world, especially in Europe. They took a lot of stuff from Egypt and other places. Well, it's not that anymore. If it's done like that anywhere, it's usually illegal. Fabulous discoveries. Anybody recognize that? Ark of the Covenant. Has that been found?
No.
Where is it?
Jesus knows.
What is the Bible? Doesn't it mention that it's in heaven, I think, if I remember right.
Mark, quick comment on that, though, is we actually know, you know why we know what it looks like, though?
Go ahead, Dave.
Is the Arch of Titus in Rome has the items that were in the temple engraved in them because the Romans put them there as trophies. A lot of that was brought back to Rome and probably melted.
Uh-huh. Well, I know they had the menorah on there.
Yeah.
Did they have a picture of the ark?
I don't remember.
They may have.
I remember the items were there.
Yeah. I think Ethiopia claims they have it. You know, the Christians down there say they have, or excuse me, the Jews, the Ethiopian Jews. Hard work? Sure. Danger? A little bit. When you're in the field digging, no cobras in this country, but we do have rattlesnakes, scorpions, and spiders, cactus. Yeah, you're going to get bruised and hurt a little. So I always told people when you're going in the field, just bring a big stick when you go near a bush or something, shake it some, and get the rattlesnakes out before you can start digging underneath there. Can archaeology prove the Bible? That's a question to you. Can it prove it correct or incorrect? Anybody like to try an answer to that? Yes.
It can help verify it.
It can help verify it. Is it reasonable to even ask, expect the Bible to ever prove it? Probably not.
No, yeah. It's reasonable to expect the case for verification of Scripture from outside sources to be very reliable.
Okay.
So mm-hmm.
That's exactly what biblical archaeology is doing, is looking to see if those things mentioned in the Bible, those places, those people, are real. Or they're not. Is the Bible mistaken? And so biblical archaeologists try to keep an open mind, and they get out there and look for these things. But will it ever absolutely prove the Bible? There's a lot of things that will never be found that are mentioned in the Bible. Yes, Al?
Does the archaeology, does this pinpoint the Mount Sinai, exactly where it was, where Moses went up?
No, it can't pinpoint Mount Sinai. It can't pinpoint where that Moses even existed. It can't pinpoint the route of the Exodus. You can only estimate at this point. And as new things are discovered, you know, you kind of refine the model and get closer and closer to an accurate account. But as far as the mountain that Moses went up on, Mount Sinai, there's a range of mountains there, and that's the best they're doing, is just saying it's somewhere in that range.
Well, because on one of the history channels, they had this thing where the way they describe the surroundings in the Bible, they think they found the actual Mount Sinai. It's an enemy, I think it's in some type of enemy territory.
I saw that one too. And they found the springs where they think Moses hit the rock and the water came out. And there's no water coming out of it now. Yeah, John, did you find it? You found it, okay.
Sinai is probably almost for sure in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
Paul in the New Testament talked about Sinai being in Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one indication. Another indication is that the mountain was probably a volcano. From all the descriptions,
sounds like it.
There are no volcanoes in the Sinai Peninsula.
Right. Mm-hmm.
None. But there are in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So more likely than not.
So the range is big, Al. It's they can't pinpoint it. Not yet. The time may come. John?
I remember looking at that report, and it seemed very credible. Local people referred to the area as the Caves of Moses, and they also found some writings on some of the rock formations in Paleo-Hebrew.
Mm.
And there even was the remnants of some kind of a pillar, I think, that the Saudis later removed, but it may have been something put there by Solomon to commemorate the location.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saudis have it fenced off as a forbidden area. No one is allowed to.
Okay. Right. Well, that's true for the whole political scene there in the Mideast. It's including the Temple Mount. You know, it's everything is so political. Things are hidden. You know, artifacts are found, and if you take this course, you're going to see something very interesting on Moses, some Egyptian pictographs that you know, I really can't say much about, but there are things that have been found that have not been published, and that may. Now, let me move on, because I'm going to show you a video in 20 minutes, so let me move on here a little bit, okay? A little bit of history, phase one. I'm going to go through about five phases here. Edward Robinson, Eli Smith, Americans back in the 1800s, consulted the local Arabs for place names, corrected the maps with those names, explored the Siloam tunnels, Jerusalem, and Temple Mount. So those are the first guys that started doing scientific work there. Lieutenant W.F. Lynch charted the Jordan River, Sea of Galilee, determined that the Dead Sea was the lowest point on Earth at 1,300 feet below mean sea level. Frederick de Saussay, first modern excavator of Palestine, through primitive digging, and he did miss ID things, but at least he tried. And a lot of his work kind of fueled Eric von Donovan or Donakin, his stories about aliens and godlike beings. It got the ball rolling. Phase two, investigation by societies, Palestine Foundation Fund, that was the British, Charles Warren. A lot of you have heard of Warren's Tunnel. And American Palestine Exploration, John Payne, noted for identifying Pisgah. Deutsche Palestina Verein, the Germans, Gottlieb Schumacher, surveyed the Golan east of the Sea of Galilee. And a French team did general surveying all over the area there. And here's a cross-section of a tail. You see tail on your vocabulary list? And probably the first tail I ever really dug on was not in the Holy Land. It was in Turkey, Troy. So I think you've all heard of that Troy was found by Heinrich Schliemann. And you can see in here how they're... let me read the definition of tell. Mound or ruin heap, hill or mound of a series of progressively older occupation layers, ruined cities built one over another in a chronological order consisting of oldest at the bottom and newest at the top. If you look at those layers there, layer two at the bottom is the prehistory city, and layer six is Homer's Troy, and above that was a Roman Acropolis. Well, William Petrie took the concept of digging these things up from Schliemann and applied it to the Holy Land. So that's how it got started there. But you can see how, you know, layer after layer, city after city, you go to some place like Megiddo or well, many of the other tales, there could be 50 layers, 50 different cities deep. We'll get to see that in a minute on the video. So Petrie really got the ball going on tails. By the way, there are probably over 1,000 tails in the Holy Land. Syria has the most, and they're not digging them. And they let very few teams go in to dig them. Yes?
Yes. Do we have similar things for Indian artifacts here in California and our own Southwest?
Good question. Here in the Southwest, no, because it's they rarely built one city on another. You know, like, and they aren't as old, of course. You know, people haven't been here as long. Unless you get back to the Mideast, Eastern and Mid U.S. Remember, you've heard of the mound builders? They did some of that. Now, they haven't excavated enough of those to really know what's going on inside, whether they're layers or it was all done in just one big mound all at once. So that has yet to be determined. And the Native Americans don't really care for archaeologists getting in there and digging those up. So, you know, there's other reasons that we can't find some things. Phase four, systematic archaeology. Things are getting more scientific. Sophistication brought to the field through methodological and scholarly scientific investigation. Concept of locus or loci. That's where you give coordinates to where you make finds. C.S. Fisher, famous for excavations at Megiddo. William Albright, who's probably the most profound biblical archaeologist, influence still impacts us today. Mastered the craft of ceramic topology and stratigraphic analysis. posited that all places, events, dates mentioned in the Bible were without error. So he's what we call a maximalist. He just assumes that everything in the Bible is absolutely correct. And we'll get more into maximalists and minimalists in a minute. And then Benjamin Mazar, he's the first Israeli biblical archaeologist to conduct official excavations. And his daughter, a lot of these people, their progeny go into archaeology too. So Benjamin Mazar's daughter is Elette Mazar, and she's the one working the City of David now. And she claims that she's found David's palace there. And, you know, that's right outside of the temple, Temple Mount area. And so there's videos that she has out on that. Very exciting. The minimalists, the people that don't believe in the Bible, will strongly disagree with that. So here's a very famous archaeologist. Phase 4 methodological revolution, 1948 to 1967, Kathleen Kenyon, a student of William Albright, developed the archaeological method and Wheeler Kenyon method. She dug in small squares with grids, leaving intervening catwalks or balks, B-A-L-K-S. Show you one of those in a second. So that was a revolutionary way to really do things scientifically. Very painstaking and expensive, though. There you go. Yeah, John?
Kathleen Kenyon, yeah, she was a very good archaeologist, but her methodology when it came to Jericho, which is what a lot of people quote.
Don't give anything away now. Yeah, we're going to go into it.
It was very flawed.
Yes. Okay. I'm glad you can, if we have time at the end, we'll even go back over that. But here's what it looks like when you start doing a dig on a tail, one of those big mounds. And you can see they've left these catwalks in between, these walls. They actually dug down here and took all the stuff out. And if they reach a little structure in a house, like a whatever these are, they leave those, and they leave the catwalks or the box in between it. The same method. And why did Kathleen Kenyon want to do something like that? You know, that was different than the other archaeologists had done. They had done dug systematically, but she wanted to leave something. What was the point of that? Well, let's take a look here. That's the side of a bulk, and in it, the stuff she did not take were these potteries. And they still remain in a bulk at Jericho. This is Jericho that John was just mentioning. And why leave it? Well, you know, you can look at the vertical face that way and measure pottery as you go down. You've all, you know, Hugh tells us at times about how we look at fossils. We can tell how old the geology is by the fossils. If you can't do radiometric dating, look at the fossils, and we know when they were around. It's the same with pottery. It's a great tool. You can look at the type of pot that was there, and you'll know what period it came from, what age. And I'm not talking millions of years. I'm talking like tens of years. So you can really get it accurately. And as the time goes by, Kathleen Kenyon, she was smart enough to realize, well, if you leave some there, they'll have new technology in 2012 or something. And they can test it in different ways. New radiometric dating or photoluminescence, something new and different. And so leave it for the future, people. Let them get a hold of it. Phase 6. This is now. They combine the Wheeler Kenyon method with archaeological method. And there's some of the people that are modern archaeologists, biblical archaeologists. Then these people don't necessarily agree with each other, but they use her methods a lot. The archaeological method is where you go out and you look at a huge field, you survey it, and you do tiny little digs here and there. Whereas the Wheeler Kenyon method was, you saw it with the bulks and the heavy concentration of work. So if you combine the two, you can look at big areas and get a good sampling and just do specific areas with deep digging and the Wheeler Canyon method. And you can make your money go further because it's very expensive. They rely very heavily on volunteers. Oh.
Yeah. I read the Israel Defense Science.
Yeah.
And he had a colleague, Neil Asher Silverman.
Mm-hmm.
I think it came out about 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I think I gave my copy to Mr. Ross. Their conclusion was that there was no flight from Egypt, no wandering in the
right.
desert, no dramatic conquest of the promised land.
Al, you're still in my thunder. Can you let me get to that in a minute? Believe me, I'm not going to miss it. Hey, oh, yes, sir.
Can you give an example of the architectural method?
I know we use it here in the southwest U.S., Native American areas. We'll go and send out a team of people and scour the area. This is a very superficial first survey. And we're simply looking for surface artifacts, flints, arrowheads and things, to see if there were even any natives there, any Native Americans there. So that's probably the minimum you would do for the architectural method. Now, for a more in-depth method, you would carry tools with you, and actually, if you started to find something like a flint, you would dig around that area and try to get a little more details and flag it. And then later, a senior archaeologist would determine how, if they're going to do a detailed work beyond this architectural method. Yes, John.
Yeah, Wellhausen, he's one of my nemesis.
I'm going to get to him.
Yeah, archaeology, as you will probably be pointing out, consistently shot down the documentary.
Yes.
Time and time.
Did you take the biblical archaeology class already?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Okay. Yes.
I was curious, do those folks use acoustic methods where you drop a big weight and then you have microphones all over the area and you're able to draw a map of what's under the earth there?
They do. That's a good point. That's just some of the modern technology that we spoke of. And yeah, you can use, it's like sonar, and you can use a radar too, like with electromagnetic rays. So you can use sound or electromagnetic wave, bounce it through the ground, see what reflects back, and you can get an idea. Now, if it's a really sensitive area, people don't want you digging it, that's better than nothing. At least you get a rough idea. Or if you have a huge area, that's another way to do the architectural method. They can actually do that by airplane to some degree. And that's how they found... from what I understand, the couple of the other rivers, what are the ones mentioned in Genesis? Yeah, they were able to see it by Landsat, I think. What was that? The
lost city of Ubar was found by
okay, by satellite. And old trade routes, too. They can see where the earth is beaten down, where now it's covered with sand and stuff. You can see it from this radar that penetrates the ground. And let me move on here. Okay, here's Wellhausen, which John was bringing up. Oh, okay. This is the group, sort of the higher learning or the more liberal side that started back in, around 1800 to question the Bible a lot. And, it's legitimate. They should question the Bible. But eventually it got pretty strong, and they came up with the idea that the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Bible, it's too jumbled to be correct. It's just a bunch of stories put together. They had historians and other archaeologists look at it, and they actually divided the Pentateuch, the five first books of the Bible, into four parts, the J, E, D, and P. And I don't have time to get into much detail on that, but... And then they said the Jews took the first two, J and E, and redacted those two. And then later, they were taken into captivity in Babylon in 586 BC, more redaction occurred. And finally, we got what we have today. And the more liberal side, it didn't happen until the Hellenistic period, which is when the Greeks were here, you know, around the 300 BC time period. And so that was what they were saying, that it was all stories that were taken from other countries and other societies and put together to make the Bible. And that stuck on. That was around to around 1940. And we started getting more evidence. And I'm running out of time if we're going to watch our video, so I'm going to try to get through this a little quicker. But some of the allegations that the documentary people also call Wellhausenists, one was writing was unknown. They couldn't write. The Hebrews didn't know how to write. Moses, the Hebrews couldn't have written any of the Pentateuch. How can you write it if you don't know how to write? Well, some of the things we found, the Gezer calendar, that's from a Canaanite city, which, of course, the Hebrews are highly mixed with the Canaanites. And that was from 925 B.C., and it shows writing was well-known even to children. The Ugaritic tablets from 1400 B.C., found in 1926. Hebrew-related Semitic language. Semitic is like similar to Hebrew language, all in that Mesopotamian area. And Wellhausen said that the Canaanite poetic books were supposed to have arisen 1,000 years later, but they were there from the year 1400. Sarah Bit El Kadim, alphabetic inscription, Proto-Semitic graffiti, similar to later Phoenician, found in 1500 BC, in Egyptian turquoise mines. Shows even low-class society could read and write. That's in 1500 B.C. So that's well before Moses. Steve?
And that Sarah Bit El Kadim is a turquoise mine worked by Hebrew slaves during the Egyptian time.
Exactly. Oh, well, it was Hebrew slaves or their close, I don't know if you say relatives, but another Semitic group called the Hyksos. Hyksos, who had actually ruled Egypt from 1600 to 1450 B.C. And they were Semitic. And they may have been the very people that put the Jews into slavery. You know, there's no way to know for sure. But anyway, the mines had, that writing on it in graffiti form. So even before Moses' time. And another allegation, Abraham and descendants were untrustworthy and non-historical. Well, there's a whole list of things we found. And city of Ur, and that's been discovered. The name Abram, found in a Kittian script, said a farmer named Abrahama hired an ox. So the name was well known, and that was in 1556 B.C. The Mari tablets, 20,000 mid-Euphrates River, and found in 1933. And it mentioned Abraham's brother, Nahor. And the city was named after him. The Nazu tablets on the Tigris River in 1925, 15th century B.C. A Hittite legal code. And camels. The documentary people said there weren't any camels around then. You know, we see it in the story of Rebecca. Remember when Jacob's wife, remember the servant went on the camel to get her, and several other things. But they found a fodder list, fodder being food, from old Babylonia from 2000 to 1700 BC, and early Sumerian text speaks of camel milk. So those are non-biblical. You know, we're finding non-biblical things that support the Bible. Let's see here. Allegation, priestly code had to be post-exilic, past the exile. And I've mentioned that earlier, but the Code of Hammurabi, which is not Jewish, but it was a large stela, which is a big stone, is like 10 feet tall, with a lot of writing on it, set from the year 1780 B.C. Actually, it's a 6-foot finger, with a fingernail on the end with a lot of figures on it. It has 282 laws on it, rules such as eye for eye, breach of contract, and divorce. So all those rules are well known in Abraham's time. It's nothing new. But documentary folks said that those didn't come up till much later. John?
Interesting, you're well aware, I'm sure, that in the biblical text, I think it's in maybe Chronicles, I'm not sure, it lists about 20 to 22 kings, their names, that exist over a long period of time. And you take other cultures like Egypt and so on, where they list their kings, and history has shown that they get a horrific amount of them wrong. But the biblical list, perfectly right on.
Well, here's another allegation that the Hebrew conquest of Transjordan and Palestine were unhistorical and out of harmony. And Egyptian accretion texts, these are voodoo type rituals whereby Seth, starting in the 1820 BC, they had found with written curses on them. Many with Pharaoh's enemies, bowls were broken and buried for effect. Some shards, those are the pieces of the bowls, tell of rebellious kings and cities in Palestine during time of Pentateuch. The Tel El Amarna tablets, that's from 1400 BC. Akkadian cuneiform messages from Palestine and Syrian princelings in Egypt, telling of alarming reports of depredation of fierce invaders and urgent requests for Egyptian troops, mentioning Habaru Apuru. And what does that sound like? Sounds like the Hebrews, doesn't it? And so Merneptah, Victory Stela from 1229, contains the only extant reference to Hebrew nation as Israel, the first time we see it in any other language. That's on a 12-foot tall stela. Ebla tablets is kind of was the last straw for the documentary folks, and discovered in 1964 20,000 clay tablets from 2500 BC mention all kinds of names of Hebrews, kings and other people. The names are general names, but they're the same names the Hebrews used. And a lot of other stuff with that. And then finally, when the documentary folks went away, or almost went away, they're still around some, a new group came up back in the 90s called the Minimalists. And these are the folks that are very anti-biblical. And it's a movement or trend that made two claims. First, the Bible cannot be considered reliable evidence for what has happened in ancient Israel. So it makes an assumption that the Bible is wrong. And is that scientific? No. And that Israel itself is a problematic subject for historical study. So it doesn't even believe in they don't believe David or Solomon existed, or if they did, they were just minor chieftains of cow towns and prairies and things in the Judean area, which is the southern part. They agree that Israel, the northern part, probably was a real Iron Age people, but where Jerusalem and the southern Judah was after the split of the nation, they believe it was very primitive, and so therefore you couldn't have had David and Solomon there, or they were really just little small time leaders. And their two groups kind of coined each other as these names, minimalist and maximalist. And most archaeologists are in between. But even the I'm going down to the maximalists there. There's two groups. The ones that, there's the secular maximalists that will believe in some of the history of the Bible, but not most of it. And then there's the traditional ones, the Bible carrying maximalist, and that would be like Bryant Wood, who you're going to see on the video here in a minute.
How do the minimalists that deny David's existence, for example, deal with the two seals that have been found referring to the house of David? One of them dated 800.
Well, here it is, right here.
Okay.
Yeah. Tell Dan Stella. Or Stila. Stila. 19, it was found between two fragments, between 93 and 94. Aramaic stela at this excavation by Abraham Byron of Hebrew Union College dates from 9th century B.C. Inscription reads House of David, which means King of the Dynasty of David. So what? He found a rock that said House of David. What's the big deal? Why is that a big deal? Because there's nothing with David on it, right? And so someone finally found something that mentioned David. And that's strong evidence that there was. Now, this wasn't from David's era. It's 100 years later. But it's enough to show that this fragment...
It was a non-Hebrew source, I think.
The non-Hebrew, yeah. It's Aramaic. From Assyrian.
Mark, how populated was the kingdom of David at the time of his rule? Do you know what the population was about?
Yeah, it might have been about 60,000, 60 to 100,000. It wasn't, that's a lot of people for back then. Remember, most towns might have 100 people in them. A city was 1,000 compared to us now. Or if you go to India now, a small town has 1,000,000 people. So, it's quite different. It depends where you're at. But that was enough during David's time to tax people and have enough income to build some structures. Now, Solomon, of course, really went gangbusters and taxed his own people almost to death and brought in resources from everywhere and did a lot of construction. But the Misha Stela found a century ago, this 9th century B.C. Moabite inscription also read House of David. So this is something that's been in a museum for a while. Carbon-14 radiometric dating of the Northern Kingdom. This is what we were talking about earlier. Israel Finkelstein, who's a minimalist, who believes the way he gets out of any evidence being found that David and Solomon were real and that they had a real major kingdom, he says, no, we got the timeline shifted. Instead of David couldn't have been around in the 10th century B.C., the very end of the 10th century would be 900 and so B.C. He had to be around 100 years later. And so, which then would put him, Judah had become more primitive 100 years later. You know, it was during after the split and the kings were there. And so the minimalists will play with the timelines and try to move David into an area or an era of, and Solomon, of less complexity and less technology and less fortune. And so what we've done, though, we found some carbon-14 dating in different areas that refute him. Or in this one site here called Kirbit Kayafa, this is a military stronghold that was found recently. And it shows, it's in Judah, which is the southern kingdom. And so this is what gives the minimalists the most heartburn, because how could there be this strong military stronghold in the southern kingdom, and it's dated to the end of the 10th century B.C., which means David and or Solomon had a strong military establishment there. It's right on the Philistine border. And so they're using the dates Israel Finkelstein came up with for this. And so it contradicts the minimalists greatly. And some of the other evidence they found there, no pig bones. Usually in sites you find pig bones if they were Philistine or anyone else. They ate pig. Jews did not eat pig. And so they found the gates faced Jerusalem instead of back towards Philistine area. And that, back then different societies would face the gates of their city towards what they worshiped. And let's see, what else did they find? Double casement walls, common in Judah, but not in Philistia. Pot shards, ostracons, they're called, with writing, with proto-Canaanite Hebrew letters in Hebrew language. So this site, this Kirbit Kayafa, There's really strong evidence that Judah was technologically advanced for the time that David and Solomon are there. And this is all like an 80-year difference on the scale. That's all. The minimalists are arguing that it's 80 years later, and maximalists are saying, no, it's back then. And that 80 years makes a big difference of saying whether or not David existed, or if he did, if he existed as a real powerful king, and Solomon. So it can get that hair splitting. Yeah, John.
There's a new steel, Stella, or Stell. Nobody knows how you pronounce
it. I see it many different ways.
That there's heavy indication on that Stell that Israel is in reference to honor, and that Stell dates back into the 1400s.
Mm-hmm.
That was revealed in biblical archaeological reviews.
That's, which one? Is that the Tel Dan Stela?
No.
A new one?
200 years old.
Oh. Well, yes.
Why is 80 years so important?
Because if you move it from past the end of the 10th century B.C., 80 years into the 9th century B.C., we know that Judah was in a very poor state then. It might have been Hezekiah's time or the king before him. And remember, they were actually fighting with Israel. The two nations were in conflict, and they were like economically going down, and they weren't building structures, and so they had a lot of hard times. So if you move David into that time, that means he was nothing, or he didn't even exist. It's all a myth. And so, whereas if you can move him back to the 10th century, we know Israel, the northern kingdom, was very powerful. We find structures built all over. It took a lot of money and resources. And now we're finding some in the southern area too. So that's why it...
So they did in fact become more primitive after a century.
Yes, they did. Okay, now let's watch the video. And if you want to, it's about a half hour long. You know, if you don't want to stay past, it's going to run about 10 minutes late.
So, what did you get out of that? I mean, what do you think? John?
I have multiple copies of this. The one thing that they left out was that Kathleen Kenyon excavated in a poor part of Jericho.
Yes.
And so you would only get lower class pottery.
Right. Okay.
When you go to where John Garstang dug, it was beneath, I believe, a palace.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. In that area.
Exactly. So Kathleen Kenyon, as brilliant as she was and as great and helpful as she was in the field of archaeology, a little pride got in the way maybe, you know, we can't say for sure, but she made a mistake. And what was it that he said? What was her mistake? What did she base her conclusion on? Lack of evidence. Something not there. And does that mean you can't, Cypriot pottery, very good. Does that mean you can't do that? No, you can do that, but you don't make your final conclusion on that. Yeah.
It seems to me that Finkelstein and Asher, two Israeli archaeologists,
yes,
they said that that conquest never happened. And what happened was that the Israelites came up, and they intermarried with the Canaanites.
Right.
There never was a big battle there. There never was but that's what they're concluding.
Yeah, that's one of the minimalist arguments. And that's definitely what they believe. And but I hope you all enjoyed this. Now, I'll be back next week with some more stuff. We'll get into the New Testament and all.
Okay.
So be here. I'm calling this Biblical Archaeology Introduction. Oh, the video? You know, I'm sorry I didn't show you guys all my resources, and I'll do it next week, but I didn't bring the video with me. I will bring it next week and show you the actual box. I think it's called Jericho Unearthed. So let me say a prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Thank you, Lord, for this time together, and letting us go over like this. And we thank you for archaeologists, Lord, and ask you to bless them and show them how to search for the truth and not be biased against your word, Lord, and to use it as a real mighty historical document that it is. And yet to not be go overboard too, Lord, and put things and imagine things that aren't really in your word. And we ask you to bless us, Lord, that we can go and do our part of your great commission this week. And bless you, Ross, and wherever he's at, give him strength and endurance and safety. In Jesus' name, amen.